bipartisan support. And on Friday, the House did an about-face and passed the sweetened version as well. It hadn't been pretty, but during a national emergency, a Democratic-controlled Congress, with some Republican support, had passed a politically radioactive $700 billion Wall Street rescue for a Republican administration in just 16 days. The bill gave Treasury remarkably expansive power, making it clear that Hank didn't even have to use the Troubled Assets Relief Program to buy troubled assets. Barney Frank joked that he could use it to buy gravel if he wanted. That was not Hank's plan, but by the time the bill passed, the Treasury and the Fed were focusing on a different alternative to buying troubled assets. Chapter 5. Dousing the Fire, October 2008 to May 2009. The passage of TARP was a turning point, the moment when the democratically elected branches of government officially recognized that the crisis posed a grave threat to the economy and gave crisis managers expanded authority to stabilize the financial system. But the system remained unstable for quite a while. Part of the problem was simply that the system was in such bad shape. It had been taking hits for 14 months, and the chaos of September, not only the collapse of Lehman, but the near failures of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, Merrill Lynch, and AIG, along with the unprecedented run on money market funds, had been a devastating blow to credit markets and confidence. The approval of $700 billion worth of assistance was welcome news, but the system had more than $700 billion worth of problems, and fear was building about the solvency of other significant financial firms. In fact, the spread reflecting stress in interbank lending hit an all-time high during the week after Congress enacted TARP. The stock market had its worst week since 1933. Clearly, the mere existence of TARP wasn't going to quell the panic. We needed to announce a clear plan to settle the markets immediately, and we needed to implement it quickly. Unfortunately, the no-confidence virus that had infected mortgage securities, firms exposed to mortgage securities, and firms exposed to the exposed firms, had also spread to the Fed and the Treasury. We were supposed to make things better, yet things kept getting worse, and markets were increasingly skeptical that we could control the contagion. They wanted to see a consistent and forceful strategy they could rely on, but the constraints on our authority had contributed to a sense that we were making it up as we went along, saving some firms but not others, falling behind the curve of the crisis. And now that Congress had finally expanded our authority, with TARP, Hank decided not to use it to buy troubled assets. It looked like we were improvising again, but in a crisis, it's vital to have the courage to change course when the times demand it. One reason the fire still looked so ominous despite our upgraded firefighting equipment was the worsening state of the broader economy. It had slipped into recession the previous December, but the turmoil of the fall had accelerated the doom loop between the financial sector and the real economy. Job losses and loan defaults, further sapping confidence and depressing asset prices, leading to more belt-tightening, layoffs, defaults, and fire sales, deepening the financial crisis as well as the economic downturn. As the economy imploded, it became increasingly rational to assume the worst about struggling U.S. financial firms. And the situation was at least as bad in Europe, where seven different nations had to step in to nationalize one or more failing institutions. Still, now that we had TARP, we felt like we could finally get ahead of the curve. Deploying TARP. When we first proposed TARP, Hank believed asset purchases would be a better mechanism for restoring financial stability than capital investments. His goal was to recapitalize the banking system. But in the past, whenever governments had injected capital directly into private banks, the terms had often been so punitive that only failed or failing banks had accepted the capital, resulting in expensive nationalization of the weakest banks without much recapitalization of the entire system. Hank believed that buying distressed assets would boost the prices of assets remaining in the banks, strengthening their balance sheets, improving their capital positions, and shoring up investor confidence. By contrast, capital injections raised the specter of nationalization, which risked accelerating the flight from the major banks. In recent weeks, shareholders in Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and AIG had been nearly wiped out after the government had taken equity stakes in those enterprises, and Hank feared that other bank shareholders would flee if they thought their equity was at risk of getting diluted as well. He was also concerned about the political reaction to what might look like a partial nationalization of the financial system. While we were seeking emergency powers from Congress, we had to deal with the two largest bank failures in U.S. history, Washington Mutual and Wachovia, and by the time TARP was enacted, the situation was deteriorating at an alarming rate. We needed immediate action to settle the markets. And it quickly became clear that designing a fair and effective program of asset purchases would be a complex and difficult task. The bottom line was that the system needed more capital, and buying assets was an indirect and inefficient way to boost capital levels. There was also no easy way to determine which assets Treasury should buy and how much it should pay. Hank's team considered various approaches involving auctions and partnerships with private sector investors, but it was clear that setting up a workable program would take 6 weeks or longer. We would revisit some of these ideas in the coming months, but we needed a simpler, swifter, and more efficient approach to get help to the system while there was still a system to help. By the time Congress approved TARP, we all agreed that injecting capital directly into financial institutions by having the government buy their newly issued stock would be a much easier and quicker way to stabilize the banking system than by buying their assets. It would also be much more powerful and cost-effective. We needed to stretch every TARP dollar as far as we could. $700 billion was a lot of money, but we were worried that asset purchases could blow through all of it without resolving the underlying problems. Hank's team also decided to buy non-voting preferred stock rather than common equity, which would help calm fears of a government takeover, and to do so on relatively attractive terms, so that strong as well as weak banks would accept the capital and restore confidence in the system. For 14 months, our powers had been limited to the Fed's efforts to address liquidity problems. Now, government capital could finally address the underlying solvency problems. But with the panic building, banks still struggling to finance themselves, and the magnitude of the potential losses increasing, we feared that capital injections alone would be insufficient to stabilize the system. Creditors and investors were still pulling back from strong as well as weak financial firms. The simplest and most powerful way to ensure that banks could attract financing was to guarantee their debts, just as Treasury had done for money market funds after the Reserve Primary Fund broke the buck. We wanted to make a credible commitment that there would be no more haircuts or defaults, because that's how confidence gets restored and runs are stopped. And we had seen with the money funds that the markets considered federal guarantees to be credible. Several European countries had already decided to provide comprehensive guarantees for their bank liabilities, so our defenses would have to be similarly comprehensive. It occurred to us that since the FDIC did have the power to backstop failing banks one at a time, it could invoke its systemic risk exception to backstop all banks at once. FDIC Chair Sheila Bair was reluctant to expose her agency's deposit insurance fund to more risk, and had criticized our whatever-it-takes approach to protecting systemic institutions as overly generous to Wall Street. But she had seen the chaotic market reactions to the defaults by Lehman and WaMu, and to her credit, she agreed to consider guaranteeing some bank obligations. Initially, Bair pushed to limit the guarantees by restricting them to newly issued debt, excluding the debts of bank holding companies, imposing punitive fees on banks that used the guarantees, and even limiting the guarantees to 90% of the debts, an implicit 10% haircut. She argued that she had only $35 billion in her insurance fund, so she had to be careful about risk. But we argued that taking some risk up front to protect banks against runs would reduce the risk that cascading failures would drain her entire fund, and she had the ability to borrow from the Treasury to backstop her fund. The FDIC could also increase fees on the financial industry to replenish its fund after the crisis was over. We wanted to throw everything we had at the crisis, so even as we raced to hash out the details of the government capital and guarantees, we were launching additional efforts to protect the system. The Fed set up a new lending program to prevent the collapse of the commercial paper market, so major corporations could finance their operations for longer than a day or two. The Commercial Paper Funding Facility, CPFF, involved another novel interpretation of the Fed's emergency authority, but it would buy $242 billion worth of paper in its first week, helping to unclog important short-term credit channels for businesses. And the program would end up earning $849 million for taxpayers, never incurring a single loss. At the same time, with an unprecedented chill spreading through the global economy, we announced some unprecedented actions with our global counterparts. First, the Fed helped organize the first-ever coordinated interest rate cut by the major central banks. The half-point reduction didn't reverse the erosion in market confidence, but it did signal an international commitment to easing monetary policy to promote growth. No small achievement, considering the hawkish European Central Bank had just tightened policy in July. Hank and Ben, with support from Mervyn King of the Bank of England, also engineered a remarkably strong statement by the G7 nations pledging urgent and exceptional action to end the crisis, foregoing the arcane jargon and diplomatic caveats that characterized most communiques, to commit that each country would use all available tools to support systemically important financial institutions and prevent their failure. Our whatever-it-takes approach to the crisis was now the official policy of the major economies. We still needed to finalize our capital program and the FDIC guarantees over Columbus Day weekend. Our challenge was to devise terms tough enough to protect taxpayers, but not so tough they would discourage participation by strong firms and stigmatize the program. We did not believe we could force firms with capital ratios above their regulatory minimums to participate in TARP, and we were worried that if only the weakest firms accepted government capital, the markets would run from those firms while the rest of the system would remain undercapitalized and vulnerable. So while we did tighten some restrictions on CEO compensation that Congress had set as a condition for participation in TARP, we did not impose restrictions on compensation and bonuses for other bank executives. We wanted to maximize participation so we could get enough capital into the system and broad enough guarantees to break the panic. We also made the terms of the capital injections compelling to the banks. Treasury would buy preferred stock with a 5% dividend increasing over time to 9%, with warrants, that is, options to buy additional stock at a fixed price in the future, that would ensure some upside for taxpayers if the firms did well. The goal was to make the capital attractive enough that all banks would accept it, but with incentives for them to replace it with private capital as market pressures eased. For the guarantees, Bear agreed to apply the FDIC backstop to borrowing by bank holding companies as well as banks, charge fees low enough to avoid stigma, and guarantee debts in full rather than imposing haircuts, which, after all, would have defeated the purpose of the guarantees. But in order to reduce the FDIC's risk, she insisted that the backstop could apply only to new bank debt, which meant creditors would still have to worry about potential haircuts and defaults for existing debt, although the ability to issue new debt easily did make it more likely that the banks would be able to meet their obligations on the existing debt. Our capital plan was not all-powerful either. By buying perpetual preferred stock, whose fixed dividend has to be paid before any dividends to common shareholders, we ran the risk that Treasury's capital injections would look more like loans than permanent equity investments, which could diminish market confidence that the system was being adequately recapitalized. Still, we were reasonably certain that TARP would attack liquidity as well as solvency problems, reducing the risk of runs while helping banks get healthy enough to start lending and promoting economic growth again. We believed it would also give the banks that needed more equity the breathing room to raise it from private investors without spooking the markets. We needed to launch the program quickly with a show of overwhelming force, so on Columbus Day, Hank summoned the CEOs of 9 of the most systemically important financial firms to the Treasury. The 3 of us, along with Bear and Comptroller of the Currency, John Dugan, explained that we expected all 9 of them to accept Treasury capital up to the equivalent of 3% of their risk-weighted assets, a total of $125 billion in TARP investments, along with FDIC guarantees of any new debt they issued through June 2009. It was a package deal. No government guarantees without the government capital. A few banks that considered themselves better capitalized were concerned that the program would make them look as weak as their more imperiled competitors, and all of the banks were reluctant to take on the government as an investor. But we reminded them that none of them should be confident they had enough capital to survive the severe recession that lay ahead, much less the runs that would accompany a meltdown of the system. And we would not give them the powerful guarantees unless they accepted our capital. All 9 firms needed the system to survive, and the best way to ensure that was for all 9 firms to participate in TARP. We would then make another $125 billion available to smaller banks, which wouldn't have to worry about stigma with the first 9 on board. That afternoon, all 9 CEOs accepted the TARP cash, and the stock market posted its biggest single-day point gain in history. In the ensuing months, we would move quickly to inject capital into nearly 700 smaller banks, a critically important step towards stabilizing and recapitalizing the entire banking system. Ultimately, the government would earn a substantial return on its investments in U.S. banks, but at the time, the public thought we were giving away its money to the bankers who had just broken the economy. The Europeans took a more traditional approach to their banking problems that fall, nationalizing failing banks and offering capital to other banks at terms so punitive that few agreed to accept it. As a result, their banking system would remain woefully undercapitalized for years, and their economic recovery would be slower than ours. But the very attributes that would make TARP so successful in terms of its economic objectives would also increase its unpopularity with the American public, which understandably wanted us to punish the banks with the harshest possible terms. And that was only the beginning of the end of the crisis. We now had a more effective strategy in place to respond to the financial earthquake, but the economic tsunami was just reaching the shore. In the fourth quarter of 2008, the U.S. economy contracted at an 8.2% annual rate, and shed nearly 2 million jobs as the shocks on Wall Street began rippling through Main Street. Main Street's woes were in turn worsening the problems on Wall Street, as failing businesses defaulted on their loans and laid-off workers fell behind on their payments on credit cards, student loans, car loans, and mortgages. The troubled assets on bank balance sheets grew more troubled than ever, as increased mortgage defaults and delinquencies heightened concerns about mortgage-backed securities. The worst recession since the Depression was intensifying, further complicating our efforts to stabilize the financial system. Critically, the TARP math was already turning ugly, prompting markets to wonder if our large new pot of money would be large enough to fill the system's remaining capital holes. We had only $350 billion in the initial tranche of TARP funding. We would need congressional approval to access the remaining $350 billion. So our injections of $250 billion into the banking sector left us just $100 billion in the first tranche of TARP and $450 billion overall. But a Fed analysis found the banking sector alone would need a further $290 billion in capital in a stress scenario and as much as $684 billion in an extreme stress scenario. That didn't include the costs of helping homeowners or rescuing the auto industry. We also had to deal with AIG, which had posted shockingly large losses and was bleeding yet again. This time, we decided we needed to restructure its rescue package to try to cauterize its wounds in a more permanent way. Fortunately, we now had TARP, and Hank agreed to inject $40 billion in capital into the company to satisfy the credit rating agencies and the markets that it was financially viable. The Fed also provided financing for two new vehicles to take the risk of AIG's troubled securities off its balance sheets, roping off the assets that were shattering confidence in the firm. The Fed did test whether it could persuade AIG's major creditors to reduce the value of their claims on the company voluntarily, but they would not accept even extremely modest haircuts. In theory, we could have tried to compel them by threatening to force AIG into default, but our priority was to prevent a default and the downgrades and runs it would have triggered. Threatening default is not a great way to reduce fears of default, and we had no intention of fueling the panic by sending a message that no contract was safe. It was a perilous time, made more dangerous by the fact that it was happening during the quadrennial holding period after the election of a new president. We had all been impressed by the responsible way Barack Obama handled the crisis during the campaign, and we knew he understood the magnitude of the challenge. He then signaled support for our whatever-it-takes strategy when he asked Tim to succeed Hank at Treasury, even though Tim had warned him the move would implicate him in our unpopular choices and complicate his message of change. Still, the 10-week transition between presidents felt unconscionably long. Hank and Ben took great comfort in Tim's nomination, but he had to recuse himself from dealing with financial institutions during the interregnum. And while Hank had talked to Obama regularly during the campaign, the president-elect did not continue those conversations during the transition. With guidance from Tim, Obama's other aides left Hank alone too, invoking Washington's one-president-at-a-time rule, so decisions that would affect their administration were made without their input. At the time, Hank felt somewhat abandoned, but in retrospect, Obama did the right thing by letting the Bush administration and the Fed work without interference. And realistically, no incoming president would have wanted responsibility for some of the messy actions that had to be taken before his swearing in. The first emergency during the transition involved Citigroup, a global colossus with $2 trillion in assets. It was the weakest of the big banks, with a capital hole bigger than the injection it had received from TARP, and the markets knew it. It was way too large and interconnected to fail, so the Treasury agreed to use a further $20 billion in TARP capital to buy more preferred stock, this time with a stiffer 8% dividend. But more capital alone seemed unlikely to stop its creditors and uninsured foreign depositors from running. So the rescue also included a Fed and FDIC ring fence around $306 billion of Citi's worst assets, making the company responsible for the first $37 billion in potential losses, but providing a government guarantee for 90% of any losses above that. The idea was to limit Citi's tail risk by insuring it against a worst-case scenario, which would hopefully restore enough confidence to avert the worst-case scenario. We figured this approach would be much cheaper than injecting all the capital Citi needed or buying all its bad assets, unless the entire system collapsed, and in that case, our problems would be much bigger than Citi. At the same time, consumer credit markets were paralyzed, and the Fed and the Treasury had developed a program to revive them by jump-starting the markets for securities backed by consumer credit. So Ben and his Fed colleagues invoked 13(3) one more time to create the Term Asset-Backed Securities Loan Facility, TALF, which created demand for securities backed by credit card loans, student loans, car loans, and small business loans by accepting them as collateral for Fed loans to investors. The Term Asset-Backed Securities Loan Facility program was backed by another $20 billion TARP investment in case the Fed suffered any losses on those securities, but it wouldn't end up absorbing any. And the program would help counteract the trend of banks restricting credit on Main Street when it was needed most. After our commitments for bank capital, the AIG and Citi rescues, and the consumer credit markets, we had almost exhausted our first $350 billion tranche of TARP. Meanwhile, Merrill Lynch was taking such extreme losses that Bank of America was threatening to back out of its merger, which seemed likely to trigger a run on both firms. Even if the merger went through, we suspected we'd need TARP funds to save the combined company. TARP money would also be needed to rescue failing automakers in order to avert millions of potential layoffs in the industrial Midwest. TARP wasn't designed for industrial companies, which can usually declare bankruptcy and then restructure or liquidate in an orderly fashion. But the banking system was so fragile that the debtor-in-possession financing bankrupt firms rely on in normal times was unavailable. That meant a major bankruptcy could have triggered a meltdown of the entire industry and its supply chains. So in December, President Bush approved a total of $17.4 billion worth of bridge loans for General Motors and Chrysler, as well as deals to recapitalize and restructure their financing arms. This was basically a lifeline to keep the industry alive through the transition, although $4 billion was contingent on Congress's approving the second tranche of TARP. The week before the end of his term, President Bush asked Congress to release that remaining $350 billion tranche, a politically unpleasant task he could have left to his Democratic successor. But Bush and Hank were determined to do all they could to defuse politically difficult problems such as AIG, Citi, and Bank of America so that Obama and his new team wouldn't have to, without making long-term decisions such as deciding how the automaker should be restructured or how to help underwater homeowners that would have boxed in the new president. It would be hard to imagine a tougher time to navigate a financial and economic crisis than a presidential transition. At the time, the transition's logistical and political challenges seemed terribly frustrating. But in retrospect, it went surprisingly smoothly. Congress approved the second tranche of TARP without much drama, and Hank and Ben engineered a rescue for Bank of America similar to Citi's, with $20 billion in capital from TARP and a ring fence around $118 billion of bad assets. These interventions stabilized the company. Fortunately, neither Bank of America nor Citi would ever have to make use of their special government guarantees, and both paid fees to the government for the protection they received. The Bank of America rescue was Hank's last action as a public servant, although most of the crisis-fighting policies he had championed would continue after his departure. It was perhaps fitting that Hank and Ben were later accused of improperly pressuring Bank of America to close its Merrill Lynch deal, and had to testify under oath about the rescue of the bank. We would later have that privilege again during lawsuits filed by AIG's shareholders contending that the government should have preserved more of their equity when saving the company from collapse. The firms we rescued were not usually gracious about the terms of their rescues, while the overwhelming sentiment among the public was that they shouldn't have been rescued at all. Endgame. Unfortunately, by the time President Obama took office, the financial system was still unstable, and the economy was deteriorating badly. The TARP capital and guarantees were helping, and the banks would end up improving their earnings significantly in the first quarter, but there's always a lag before financial stabilization measures show up in economic data. The fear index that measures the risk of corporate defaults was even higher than it had been after the Lehman collapse. Consumer confidence was at an all-time low. When Tim met with the president for the first time as Treasury Secretary, he warned Obama that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac had almost burned through their $200 billion in federal aid and needed another $200 billion, that the market still believed the financial system was seriously undercapitalized, and that AIG, Citi, and Bank of America were still wobbly despite their rescues. We had already distributed more than half of TARP, and doubt was spreading that we would be able to shore up the system and prevent more chaotic failures without another TARP. In fact, Obama's first budget proposal would include a $750 billion placeholder for additional financial rescues. The Fed was doing its part to try to revive the economy. In December, it reduced its target short-term interest rate essentially to zero, where it would remain for the next 7 years. Ben also announced plans for the Fed to buy $100 billion of debt issued by Fannie and Freddie, along with $500 billion worth of mortgage-backed securities guaranteed by Fannie and Freddie. This was not only an effort to revive demand for the securities and boost the sagging housing market, but a signal that the Fed would continue to support growth in creative ways, even with the short-term interest rate constrained by its zero lower bound. But more creativity from the Fed was not going to be enough. Even with interest rates at zero, even with TARP starting to weatherize banks for the building economic storm, the adverse feedback loop between economic decay and financial instability was in full swing. The new administration would pursue a variety of aggressive measures to jolt the economy back to life, including the largest fiscal stimulus bill in American history, an auto rescue plan that would force General Motors and Chrysler into receivership as a prelude to necessary restructuring, and more ambitious programs to reduce foreclosures and help homeowners. At the same time, Obama wanted a forceful plan to fix the financial system so that it would no longer hold back the rest of the economy. In that initial Oval Office meeting, he told Tim he wasn't interested in waiting around and hoping things got better. He wanted action to get the financial problems out of the way now, so he could focus on addressing the other challenges created by the Great Recession. The question was, what kind of action? There was a growing belief among financial experts across the ideological spectrum that the banking sector was essentially unsalvageable, and that the president would be forced to nationalize some or all of it. Many of Tim's colleagues in the new administration shared that view, and persistent media leaks suggesting that nationalization looked inevitable had a debilitating effect on bank stocks. Investors were rushing to sell their shares before the government could dilute them or wipe them out. Tim and Ben wanted to avoid a broad nationalization of the banking system unless it was absolutely necessary. And even nationalizing one or two major firms seemed likely to trigger panics that could lead to additional government takeovers. But with credit markets frozen and the recession getting worse, Drift did not seem like a tenable strategy either. After weeks of debate and consultation with his new team at Treasury, White House Economic Advisor Larry Summers and other Obama aides, the Fed, and the FDIC, Tim proposed a less drastic approach. His plan was designed to restore confidence in the health of banks with a mix of unprecedented transparency and new capital. Under this plan, the Fed and other bank regulators would identify, bank by bank, the size of the losses each institution might face in a severe recession and a renewed financial crisis. They would then disclose those loss estimates publicly and make sure each bank got enough capital to withstand those losses, from private sources if they could raise it, from TARP if they couldn't. Transparency was a risky strategy. If the experts were right, exposing the books of the banks to the sunlight would just unveil the depth of their insolvency to the world. But markets were already assuming the worst, acting as if the banks were the walking dead. Tim and his colleagues believed confidence would never return as long as uncertainty reigned, and they thought it was at least possible that perceptions of the health of the banking system were worse than reality. The centerpiece of his plan would be the Supervisory Capital Assessment Program, or the stress test. The Fed and other bank regulators would conduct rigorous reviews to determine whether major banks had enough capital to survive a depression-like downturn. Then it would make the results public, and banks that came up short would be given 6 months to raise the additional capital they needed. The ones that couldn't attract the investment privately would then be forced to accept additional TARP capital, and possibly government control. There was certainly a risk that many banks would end up in that situation. TARP would run out of money trying to recapitalize them, and large-scale nationalization would end up happening anyway. But preemptively putting the political system in charge of the banking system seemed like an extreme option when it was also possible that many banks were in better shape than the markets feared. Markets tend to overshoot on the way down as well as on the way up, and Tim was reluctant to turn banks into wards of the state based on fears of the unknown rather than proof they weren't viable. The stress test would provide a more accurate picture of the health of banks, and then would make sure the sick ones got the capital they needed, either voluntarily from investors or forcibly from TARP. Tim and Ben also agreed on a dramatic expansion of the Term Asset-Backed Securities Loan Facility into a $1 trillion Fed program backed by TARP funds, a move intended to broadcast the government's determination to resurrect the market for asset-backed securities. As it turned out, this extra capacity would not be needed. And Tim's team devised a new treasury partnership with the private sector to buy troubled assets, adapting some of the ideas that Hank had put on hold in the rush to get TARP out the door. The Public-Private Investment Program, PPIP, would provide TARP loans to private investment firms that would decide which assets to buy and how much to pay, so the government wouldn't have to do it, but the investors would also have to put their own money at risk and share any profits with the government. Tim unveiled his plan to break the back of the crisis in a speech on February 10th. It was the first televised address of his career, and the markets plunged while he was still speaking. This was partly because Tim was vague about the details, which were still in flux, and partly because his delivery did not exactly inspire confidence. Barney Frank said he sounded like a boy at his bar mitzvah. Markets also may have been disappointed that Tim did not endorse ideas that were floating around for the government to buy troubled assets at inflated prices. In any case, there wasn't much Treasury or the Fed could do about the ugly reaction, except to design the new programs as fast as possible and hope the details would ultimately prove reassuring. The system would be in a frustrating limbo state until the programs were ready, and then again until the stress tests were done. We just had to hope it wouldn't collapse before the markets could see the results, or, for that matter, after. In the meantime, the drumbeat for nationalization and haircuts continued, and we could feel the tremors in the markets with every fresh rumor and leak. In March, Obama convened a meeting of his economic team to debate the plan that Tim had already announced, because none of Tim's colleagues seemed happy with his approach. But none of them could articulate a workable alternative that would nationalize banks without sparking panic or draining TARP. And as Tim pointed out, plan beats no plan. Obama ultimately agreed that it made more sense to supplement and adapt the stabilization programs that were already in place than to chart a radical new course, even though his political base wanted a bold break with the Bush years. The potential downsides of the stress test were obvious. There was no guarantee that the answers it produced would be conducive to calm. But there was a reasonable chance that forcing the entire system to prepare for a depression-like event would reduce the likelihood of that depression-like event, and that its triage would help draw a bright line between fundamentally healthy banks and terminally ill banks. It would all depend on the stress test results. Some skeptics expected the test to be a sham, in which the Fed would subject the banks to a gentle scenario engineered to get them a clean bill of health. But we knew that if the stress test didn't seem credible, the markets would keep assuming the worst regardless of the results. The scenario the Fed would actually use was quite brutal, envisioning loan losses even worse than the losses during the Great Depression, and housing price decreases that turned out to be even worse than the reality of 2009. Tim's Treasury colleagues also came up with a critical tweak to limit the uncertainty of the waiting period, fixing the price that Treasury would pay for stock in undercapitalized banks at February levels, even if the price fell further before the stress tests were complete. That condition, which Tim's staff dubbed the Geithner Put, reduced the incentive for investors to run away from banks while the Fed was still pouring through their books. The waiting period was still excruciating. Citi faltered again, and Treasury had to engineer a complex deal with some of its private stockholders to bolster its capital buffer without nationalizing the bank. Then AIG needed yet another TARP lifeline, this time for $30 billion, just before it revealed it was paying lavish taxpayer-funded bonuses to some of its employees, triggering the most ferocious public backlash of the entire crisis. The rollout of Treasury's PPIP program to buy troubled assets was also attacked as a scandalous boondoggle for private investors, although it would also end up generating a modest positive return for taxpayers. Meanwhile, although the economy was still in terrible shape, with unemployment rising to 8.9% by the end of April, the pace of the deterioration was slowing. In May, the Fed released the results of its stress test, and they were much better than many in the markets had expected. The Fed determined that 9 of the 19 largest financial firms were already adequately capitalized to withstand the test's worst-case scenario, and the other 10 needed, collectively, only about $75 billion in additional capital. The Fed released the underlying data that demonstrated how it had reached its conclusions, and the market considered the results credible. The cost of insuring against defaults by financial institutions quickly dropped, and the private sector once again regained the confidence it needed to invest in banks. Within a month, the undercapitalized firms had raised almost all the capital they needed to comply with the stress test mandate. The only firm that couldn't was GMAC, so Treasury would fill the gap with a relatively modest infusion of TARP funds. Ultimately, even the rescue of GMAC, now known as Ally Bank, would generate a $2.4 billion profit for the Treasury. As late as April 2009, the International Monetary Fund was still predicting that the U.S. government would spend $2 trillion rescuing its banking system. But TARP's capital programs for banks and insurers would end up earning about $50 billion for the Treasury, and overall, our financial interventions would produce a substantially larger direct financial return, on top of the huge economic benefits from having a functioning rather than a collapsing financial system. The stress test was a somewhat anticlimactic conclusion to a 20-month ordeal, finally reassuring the markets there would be no more Lehman's. It was not a magic solution that ended the crisis. It was the culmination of a long series of emergency interventions that made the end of the crisis possible. The Fed's far-flung lending and liquidity programs, the rescues of Bear, Fannie, Freddie, and AIG, the Treasury's guarantee of money market funds, the FDIC's guarantees of bank debt, and the initial deployment of TARP funds to banks were all necessary to put out the fire, even though none of those actions was sufficient on its own. If not for all those interventions, especially the hundreds of billions of dollars worth of capital that TARP had already pumped into the banking system, along with the private capital we had pressured banks to raise since the crisis began, the results of the stress test would have been much less reassuring to the markets and much more expensive for taxpayers. What's more, if all these aggressive actions to fix the financial system hadn't been supplemented by similarly aggressive actions to revive the broader economy, the gains achieved by the dramatic innovations in strategy on and around Columbus Day would have been squandered and eroded. Eventually, the full force of the U.S. government proved to be enough to put out the fire, but just barely. Anything less would not have been enough. Just as an irreversible financial collapse would have plunged the economy into depression, a prolonged economic freefall would have forced the financial system into collapse. Our financial interventions worked only in tandem with an aggressive effort to resuscitate economic demand in early 2009. More monetary boldness from the Fed, unprecedented fiscal stimulus from Obama and Congress, a government rescue of the auto industry, and a flawed but still substantial push to revive the housing market and help vulnerable homeowners. We eventually restored normalcy by using all the financial and economic weapons at our disposal, and they were all the more powerful because they were deployed together. In a provocative speech back in 2002, Ben had argued that even at the zero lower bound, when central banks traditionally had run out of economic ammunition, they could use unorthodox measures to fight deflationary and recessionary pressures. But in 2009, the economy badly needed more help, and in early March, the Fed launched an aggressive monetary stimulus experiment known as quantitative easing, buying mortgage securities and then treasury bonds to try to bring down long-term interest rates and fight the Great Recession. The initial round, QE1, would expand to $1.75 trillion in Fed purchases and send a confidence-inducing message that the Fed would not stand by and let the economy stagnate. Ben and his colleagues would announce QE2 and QE3 in 2010 and 2012, eventually expanding the Fed's balance sheet to more than $4.5 trillion, nearly five times its pre-crisis peak. a wide range of academic studies have found that quantitative easing lowered long-term treasury and mortgage rates and helped support the economic recovery. It also encouraged other central banks to adopt similar programs to support global growth. Alongside the effects of the Fed's monetary policy actions, the new administration poured fiscal stimulus into the Main Street economy through the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009, an enormous package of $300 billion in temporary tax cuts, along with $500 billion worth of new federal spending, including relief to victims of the recession, public works designed to provide jobs while upgrading the nation's infrastructure, and direct aid to states to prevent them from raising taxes, cutting budgets, and deepening the Great Recession. Congressional Republicans almost unanimously opposed the package, attacking Obama as an out-of-control spender. But most independent economists agree that the Recovery Act helped save jobs, boost growth, and end the recession by June 2009. State and local governments, most of which faced balanced budget requirements, did offset some of its power with tax hikes, layoffs, and spending cuts, but it helped launch growth in the United States while other developed economies were still shrinking. Normally, governments should try to live within their means, but when private demand collapses, aggressive deficit spending that can jolt the economy to life is more fiscally responsible than government belt tightening that further reduces demand. Brutal recessions can blow up deficits for years. Stimulus packages that boost deficits in the short term but help workers earn taxable income again and businesses make taxable profits again can reduce deficits in the long run. The country could have afforded and the economy could have used an even larger stimulus package, but there were only 60 votes in the Senate for $800 billion, and there was no filibuster-proof support for anything larger. Congressional Democrats did quietly follow up with a dozen more modest stimulus measures, cutting payroll taxes, expanding unemployment aid, and sending more help to states, ultimately injecting a further $657 billion into the economy. The Obama administration also poured more TARP money into an aggressive and controversial auto rescue plan that forced General Motors and Chrysler into receivership as a prelude to long-overdue restructuring. Overall, the auto industry would receive more than $80 billion from TARP, but in the end, the cost to taxpayers would be only $9.3 billion, a relatively small price to pay to salvage a vital U.S. manufacturing sector. Between 2008 and 2012, the federal fiscal expansion, including automatic countercyclical stabilizers as well as discretionary stimulus, amounted to about 3.4% of GDP per year. The tax cuts and government transfers were also progressive in their impact, almost fully offsetting the aggregate decline in income experienced by families in the bottom 40% of the income distribution. Tim and his colleagues in the Obama administration also launched a series of new programs to support the housing market, building on the programs to recapitalize Fannie and Freddie and the Fed's actions to lower mortgage interest rates. The day after the Recovery Act became law, the president unveiled a housing strategy that included the Home Affordable Refinance Program, HARP, to help underwater homeowners refinance their mortgages even though they owed more than their homes were currently worth, and the Home Affordable Modification Program, HAMP, to help delinquent homeowners modify their monthly payments. Hank and the Bush administration had initiated several private sector mortgage modification efforts, but their scope had been limited by their voluntary nature and the unavailability of federal funding. Obama's efforts, backed by TARP dollars, were seen as a clear escalation, so much so that they inspired the CNBC personality Rick Santelli's famous on-air rant calling for a new anti-government Tea Party to protest bailouts for freeloading homeowners. The progressive left felt just as strongly that the government's response to the foreclosure crisis was weak and late, a betrayal of Main Street. These programs were painfully slow and disappointing in their reach. HARP, after a glacial start, would eventually help more than 3 million homeowners refinance their mortgages, while nearly 25 million more would take advantage of low rates to refinance without government assistance. HAMP was a logistical nightmare, reliant on a dysfunctional loan servicing industry that routinely lost paperwork, failed to return phone calls, and generally gave borrowers the runaround. Tim's team at Treasury thought about setting up its own servicing program from scratch, but decided there wasn't enough time, and banks were reluctant to invest in the infrastructure they would have needed to identify the mortgages that were suited for modifications and get the deals done quickly. HAMP also had onerous compliance requirements and restrictive eligibility rules to protect against fraud, which further bogged down an already unwieldy process and persuaded banks to restructure millions of mortgages privately without the HAMP subsidy rather than deal with the government red tape. Ultimately, HAMP would directly support only a fraction of Obama's goal of 3 million to 4 million mortgage modifications. But in the end, the combination of government and private sector modifications reached more than 8 million homeowners. The struggles of HARP and HAMP got a lot of attention and convinced many observers that the government's housing policies had failed. The federal actions that had the greatest impact on housing were the $400 billion lifeline for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which kept mortgage credit flowing after private capital abandoned the field, and the Fed's aggressive purchases of mortgage-backed securities, which helped keep mortgage rates low and facilitated refinancings. Programs to reduce foreclosures after a real estate crash and a deep recession were much tougher to design. The politics were treacherous, and there was no easy way to craft targeted programs to help financially distressed homeowners stay in their homes without wasting money on homeowners who either didn't need help or would never be able to afford their homes, even with government help. The preferred option of many housing activists was a principal reduction program that would reduce the amount that underwater homeowners owed. But the government couldn't just force banks to forgive mortgage debt, and providing sufficient incentives for them to do so voluntarily would have been an incredibly inefficient use of tax dollars. One 2014 study in the Brookings Papers on Economic Activity found that if the government had spent an additional $700 billion to wipe out every dollar of negative equity in the U.S. real estate market, it would have had very little impact on the broader economy, increasing personal consumption by less than 0.2% and costing an estimated $1.5 million for each job it saved. By contrast, TARP's support for the auto industry would cost about $14,000 per job saved. The Obama administration did push the Federal Housing Finance Agency to pursue some targeted principal reduction for Fannie and Freddie loans, but the independent agency resisted. What proved the more effective approach, rather than reducing mortgage principal, was to reduce monthly payments, the approach taken by most private as well as public sector loan modifications. Ultimately, the government response to the housing slump was effective in the broader sense of stabilizing the housing and mortgage markets overall. Without the nationalization of Fannie and Freddie or the Fed and Treasury purchases of mortgage securities, house prices would have fallen dramatically further, millions more Americans would have lost their homes, and the recession would have been much worse. The programs designed to help individual homeowners refinance their homes or modify their mortgages also reached millions, but they were slow to get moving and limited in scope. Congress was never enthusiastic about a dramatically more powerful housing strategy, and Tim and most of those in the Obama administration also believed that additional dollars spent on unemployment benefits, infrastructure projects, payroll tax cuts, and aid to states would have more economic bang for the buck, while raising fewer dilemmas about fairness than a new wave of programs aimed narrowly at homeowners. Solving the economic crisis was a necessary condition for solving the housing crisis, while the reverse was not necessarily true. In the end, a long and steady economic recovery might be the most successful housing program. Home prices stabilized after the Great Recession ended, gradually eliminating trillions of dollars of negative equity, lifting millions of underwater homeowners above water. The better economy made almost everything better. U.S. annual auto sales had plunged to 10 million in 2009, but they were back up to pre-crisis levels of 17 million by 2015. The credit crunch ended for most consumers and businesses, although banks remained skittish about lending for longer than we would have liked, especially to potential homebuyers. Unemployment came down rapidly from a peak of 10.0% in late 2009 to 3.7% as we write, and the economy that was shedding more than 2 million jobs a quarter in early 2009 has added some 19 million jobs over a record 97 consecutive months. Corporate profits recovered rapidly, much faster than wages did, but child poverty rates declined to historic lows. Compared with other countries in this crisis, or historical recoveries from past crises, the recession was much less severe and the recovery began much earlier in the United States. And although the recovery wasn't as strong as many had hoped, it has been unusually steady. Still, the crisis of 2008 inflicted tremendous pain. It is often incorrectly blamed for rising inequality, wage stagnation, and other economic trends that had festered for decades before getting masked by the boom. But it is correctly blamed for millions of layoffs, millions of foreclosures, and lingering trauma for millions of families. We wish we had been able to put out the fire quicker than we did. But we are grateful that the United States was able to prevent an economic catastrophe that could have rivaled the Great Depression. And we remain worried about the risk of the next fire. Conclusion. The fire next time. None of us, nor any of our accomplished colleagues, had ever lived through a crisis like this one. And despite Ben's expertise on the Great Depression, Hank's feel for financial markets, and Tim's experience with crises abroad, none of us was ever sure what would work, what would backfire, or how much stress the system would be able to handle. There was no standard playbook we could consult for guidance, no professional consensus about best practices. We had to feel our way through the fog, sometimes changing our tactics, sometimes changing our minds, with enormous uncertainty about the outcomes. And many of the things we did appeared to reward the very financial industry that had dragged the world into the crisis in the first place. So it was understandable and perhaps inevitable that commentators tended to assume and predict the worst. Critics warned that we were setting the stage for a run on the dollar, or Zimbabwe-style hyperinflation, or a Greece-style debt crisis, or trillions of dollars in bailout costs, or a Japan-style system dominated by unsalvageable zombie banks, or even the death of American free market capitalism. Ultimately, none of that happened. Not in spite of our choices, we believe, but because of them. We were fortunate that Congress eventually gave us expanded powers that allowed us to mobilize a forceful and effective response, and perhaps, in some ways, we were simply fortunate. But with a decade to reflect on what happened here as well as in other countries in this crisis, we believe that the strategy the United States adopted, and we helped shape, worked about as well as could have been hoped, given the constraints and radical uncertainties the country faced. The stress of the 2008 crisis was in some ways including the declines in stock prices and home prices, and the falls in output and employment, even worse than the early stages of the Great Depression, but this time the government managed to stop the panic, stabilize the financial system, revive the credit markets, and jumpstart a recovery that continues to this day. The U.S. recovery compares favorably to recoveries from previous severe financial crises, and the recoveries of other advanced economies from this crisis. Although it could well have been worse, the crisis was still extraordinarily damaging for both the United States and the world. Millions of Americans lost their jobs, their businesses, their savings, and their homes. One crucial lesson of 2008 is that financial crises can be devastating even when the response is relatively aggressive and benefits from the formidable financial strength and credibility of the United States. The best strategy for a financial crisis is not to have one. And the best way to limit the damage, if there is one, is to make sure crisis managers have the tools they need to fight before things get too bad. Unfortunately, financial crises will never be entirely preventable because they are products of human emotions and perceptions, as well as the inevitable lapses of human regulators and policymakers. Finance depends on confidence, and confidence is always fragile.